KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. San Francisco is home to an estimated 22,500 injection drug users, according to the city's Department of Public Health. And though many argue that number is inflated, injection drug use is becoming an increasingly visible problem in San Francisco as chronic homelessness rises and rapid development takes over users' hiding spots. San Francisco Magazine calls the rising heroin and methamphetamine use the city's, quote, greatest public health crisis since the height of AIDS, end of quote. In this hour, we talk with Gary Camilla, the magazine's executive editor, about its reporting on the injection drug epidemic and what San Francisco can do to address it, and the magazine's special report, One City Under the Syringe. Gary Camilla, good to have you back with us.
Great to be here, Michael.
I might as well plug the fact that Gary Camilla is also the author of Cool Gray City of Love, 49 Views of San Francisco, which I said was the best writing I'd read about San Francisco since Herb Cain. And now you're writing about something that really needs to have light shed on it. We're talking about, like I said, the biggest public health crisis since the AIDS crisis, and they're shooting up going all over the city.
Yeah, as you said, Michael, it's unclear whether this crisis, how much the numbers have gotten worse. I think they've gotten somewhat worse. But what's indisputable is that, you know, the numbers were obviously unacceptable to begin with, and the visibility of this problem now has become so much greater. The Civic Center area is just shocking. You walk through the park right under the windows of City Hall, and people are openly injecting.
And you're a guy who walks the city more than most.
Right.
So you see all this, but people, I'm sure, will be calling in about what they see, and not only in San Francisco, because that black tar heroin is out there, and it's easily accessible, and it's only about $10 a bag. But as you point out, things are changing even on that score, and we have to take this into account. The price of heroin's probably going up because the powdered stuff is going to become more accessible. This has a lot to do with the Colombian War being settled. I mean, ironically, that's the reason behind it. But that's already seriously ubiquitous on the East Coast. It's headed here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a huge problem. And the biggest problem, as we begin to see more powdered heroin coming into San Francisco, when traditionally, you say, it's been what's called black tar heroin, which is a much cruder, more unprocessed form of heroin. The problem with the powdered heroin is that not only is it stronger by itself so that it's more easy to OD on it, but the real problem is it's much easier to adulterate it with a drug called fentanyl, which is a synthetic opioid, which is extremely powerful. Heroin is already 3 or 4 times more powerful than morphine. Fentanyl is like 40 times more powerful than heroin, and that's one of the reasons you see this enormous increase in overdose deaths across the country. Now, we haven't really seen that yet.
We had only around 100 here in San Francisco.
Yeah, we get about 100 a year. Again, an unacceptable number, but we're not subject to the same kind of mass overdose crisis that a lot of other cities have experienced, partly because of this fentanyl problem. But as powdered heroin begins to come in, and, you know, it hasn't yet become an epidemic here, but as it begins to come in, we're almost certain to see the number of overdose deaths rise because fentanyl is so dangerous.
And the cost of heroin will rise with that, too. I mean, the cost, like you say, 100 deaths is too many deaths, and we don't need any deaths of overdoses and shouldn't have any. But the fact of the matter is that as the cost rises, of course, the crime will rise, and, you know, we're into a spiral here that's really ought to be of concern to citizens because it's, I mean, even to their pocketbook, if nothing else, is going to be costing a lot of money in justice and in incarceration. And yet there's a lot that's being done, and that's what I want to emphasize. There's, in fact, reason for optimism. But before we get into that, I want to get into just the sense of what you write about here, which is the human cost. What I liked about this series was it's a profile, in their own words, of many of these drug addicts. And you start out, for example, and this was a piece that you did, about a guy who is from Wisconsin originally. He's a glassblower. His name is Frank. And using Mexican black tar heroin, like so many of these people, as we said, these $10 bags, sounds like, by the library, in fact, here in the public library, it sounds like, you know, comes across sounding like a pretty good guy, a decent guy with values and everything, but gets caught up in this cycle. And so many of these people get caught up, thousands of Franks out there, because of opioids and because of the prescriptions with opioids.
Yeah, that's right. That's a major point of entry into addiction to heroin. obviously we overprescribed, prescription opioids for many years. The pendulum swung too far. There was a time when we didn't manage pain well. Then we suddenly, pharmaceutical companies began to promote the idea that, you know, if you did prescription opioids, there was a very low risk of addiction. Well, we now know that's completely false. So guys like this guy Frank, took drugs like, hydrocodone, OxyContin. These are extremely addictive drugs if you begin to get out of control with them. And then what happened, we now have an ironic situation where we understandably and correctly have cut back on the prescription of prescription opioids. But as a result, if you're addicted to those and you're looking around, it's often easier to score heroin than it is to score OxyContin, and it might be cheaper. And so this is an unintended consequence of the, really correct move, which was to make it less easy for patients to get prescription opioids. But, as a result, you see addiction to heroin rising. And, I was with Frank. We walked around. He let me accompany him on his rounds. And, he went into a Starbucks right across from Civic Center. He cashed a $10 gift card. I didn't know you could cash them in. He got $10. He walks over to the public library. We've all been there a million times, 8th and Market. There's always, they're mostly Latino dealers there. A lot of them are from Honduras. Very clean cut, nice young guys, everyone says, very respectful.
They're
pushers. They're pushers, but, they're pushers where, the need, there's always, I think yes, we may not like the fact that they're pushers, but demonizing them and trying to enforce our way out of this has just proven to be completely impossible. There's too much poverty. There's too much need. The business is never going to go away, and unless we deal with it at the addiction end. And San Francisco is actually doing a pretty good job of trying to do that.
Well, this is where, and we should say also, there's a high degree of relapses, of course. But this is where San Francisco comes into a kind of paradigmatic role, at least potentially, like it did in the AIDS crisis. And this is where some of the sense of optimism, I mean, all the emphasis on harm reduction and on safe injection sites, needle exchange. In fact, there's still resistance to safe injection sites, strong resistance. But nevertheless, these are making a difference.
Oh, yeah. I mean, internationally, safe injection sites, now there's close to 100 of them around the world, and there's no empirical evidence that they've been anything except a success. There's no, the criticism is that, oh, you're enabling drug use, you're going to increase dealing and crime, and none of this is true. Basically, what they do is they obviously cut down on overdoses because you're injecting in a safe facility where you have trained medical personnel there. But just as important, they provide a very low threshold access to services so that, it's this concept of harm reduction is you meet the users where they are. You don't try to impose your own morals, values, beliefs on people for whom those judgments simply are ineffective. This is all about, what works. This is a best practice. But it goes against our entire American history of moralistic hysteria about drug use, which is, it was not always thus with the way we treated, opioids. When they were being used by upper-class white women in the 19th century, doctors could prescribe them morphine, and they did. And then in 1918, 1919, as the class of people that used prescription morphine and such drugs began to change, as the demographic changed, it became more urban, more minority, there was more crime associated with it. The federal government made it illegal for doctors to prescribe maintenance morphine. And we've been on a trajectory ever since of mingling a medical approach, which is the effective approach, with a moralistic and law enforcement approach, which is, you know, I understand, we all understand why that people feel that way, but it's not effective. It doesn't have any, it doesn't have good results.
And as you say, they feel that way also about safe injection sites. It's just going to somehow exacerbate the problem. It's going to lead to maybe more of a magnet and all that sort of thing. We're talking to Gary Camilla, by the way, if you've just joined us, and we're talking about combating injection drug use in San Francisco, which has risen to a serious crisis level, almost comparable in many ways, certainly the biggest public health crisis since the AIDS crisis. And we certainly welcome your thoughts and your, well, joining the conversation. Let me invite you to do that now. Our toll-free number is available to you, and we'd like to hear from you. Any questions or comments you might have. Some of you, in fact, may want to give us some of the things you've seen out there on the streets, because it is, I'm afraid, getting worse, but there are things that are being done. And the portraits that are in the San Francisco Magazine series are really quite humanizing, I think. You find out about different addicts who love their cat, who have a close friend who helps them out of addiction, or at least find a way to remove themselves from the sort of dangers and perils one lives with addiction. But you also get the sense of how it becomes almost like a full-time job out there, just feeding the habit and making sure that the habit is fed. Let me give you the toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. I'd like to hear your thoughts and welcome you to the program. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You can also join us by emailing us, forum at kqed.org, or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at kqedforum. But we do welcome your involvement in the program, and you can also, of course, go to our Facebook page and post any question or comments there. After reading through the series, I thought, if you're an addict, best advice, get the right provider. That's
right.
Kind of a key in many ways. But also, you set up in the series ways that people, just ordinary citizens, can help, and I just want to highlight these before we go to our callers, because I think they're quite important. I mean, volunteering, first of all, but also learning how to administer the drug for the ODs, supporting resident treatment programs. I mean, these are all there. But then you mentioned earlier about the Spanish-speaking population, and in that list is reaching out to the Hispanic community. Can you be more specific about that?
Yeah, I mean, there's an organization that is very specifically targeted at Spanish-speaking people that have an opioid use disorder. And, you know, cultural competency and cultural communication is key. One of the things that
but again, I'm thinking about the pushers, as I call them, you know, the Honduran and so forth pushers.
Yeah. No, I mean, look.
A lot of them need jobs, really, don't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is not, you know, this is a venerable problem. You know, the pushers are very low level on the street. They're being paid a kind of a stipend. You know, the higher-ups are the ones that are making the money. The street pushers often carry the drugs in their mouth, is what I'm told, so that if they're arrested, they simply swallow them. They're all bagged up so they won't die of an OD. And, you know, basically we've decriminalized possession of, not totally decriminalized, but we've reduced the penalties for possession of heroin now down to a misdemeanor. So that, you know, essentially, in many ways, this is good. You know, we were clogging our criminal justice system with cases that simply the same revolving door was happening, just at a much more protracted level. So the whole law enforcement aspect of this is really a Sisyphean battle. It's kind of an unwinnable battle, and this war has to be won at the level of trying to decrease the problem and the addiction in the first place. And, you know, one of the tragic things you find out, this is a problem that's deep in American society. This goes to our fragmented families. This goes to our socioeconomic and racial situation in this country.
Can I also say it goes to child abuse, too, as mentioned in the articles?
Huge child abuse of you know, the many users that I spoke to. You know, it's just heartbreaking how many people suffered physical abuse, sexual abuse, psychological abuse that is just devastating. You know, I've heard stories. Dr. Brad Shapiro, who runs the outpatient methadone clinic at SF General, told me that this incredible story of this homeless woman who lives behind SF General. She's a middle-aged woman. She's psychotic. You know, she's very, very delusional and didn't really want to speak to anyone. And finally, someone got her to open up, and she said that when she was growing up, she was, you know, raped, sexually abused by her stepfather for years. And then he started in on her younger sister, and she kicked him to death with steel-tipped boots. And then she was put into the, you know, the criminal justice system, and then, you know, she's been, you know, psychotic and using injection drugs ever since. But these are these unthinkable things. And, you know, so many people, and you just have to remember this, when you see users and you see chronically homeless, and there's a fairly large overlap between chronically homeless and injection drug users, you have to remember that so many of these folks, you know, suffered just appalling abuse. And furthermore, and even if you're chronically homeless, that in itself is a trigger to use injection drugs because it's so painful and difficult to be chronically homeless. So if you weren't an injection drug user when you started being homeless, you may become one.
Let me bring our callers into this, and we begin with Ben from Windsor. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I'm someone that used to be homeless on the streets of a major city, Los Angeles, and I have over 20 years clean now.
Congratulations.
Thank you. My my wife runs a drug and alcohol program that works with exclusively with the homeless population in the Bay Area. And she has her – and the model nowadays is harm reduction. Of course, we were brought into the program, into recovery, in 12-step recovery, in abstinence-based recovery. And she has a really hard time with the people that are doing harm reduction. They have a really hard time getting to the next level of actually staying clean. And there's a high rate of relapse among addicts in recovery that are on Suboxone or methadone. They even allow in some programs for them to smoke pot now. And she's really frustrated with it. And I've seen the same thing in my 20 years of sobriety, is that people that don't really embrace the 12-step model, people that don't embrace abstinence-based recovery, have a really hard time staying clean.
I think that's generally the case, don't you, Gary?
Well, I think all techniques that are effective are to be welcomed, and the abstinence-based model, Narcanon, 12-step programs are effective for some people. My understanding is that empirically, actually, abstinence-based approaches are not as effective statistically as harm reduction ones. So I understand.
I think I've seen the numbers, right. And they're pretty dramatic, the difference.
Yeah. So I understand the caller's frustration.
But whatever works, right?
Yeah, whatever works. No one wants to say don't do abstinence if it works. But, you know, the fact is that for many individuals who are addicted, this is clinically called a remitting and relapsing disorder. I mean, it is incredibly difficult not to relapse. It's one of the most depressing things about this, and there's not a happy ending necessarily to this story, is the extraordinarily high percentage of users, even users that may have educational and class advantages, who relapse. It's a brain disease in that sense. And once you become addicted, it becomes very difficult to rewire your brain not to use. So I think that, you know, abstinence-based programs have their place, but I don't think that one should set them against the harm reduction model, which I think empirically has been proven to be more effective.
There's also something to be said for all of the atheist listeners are going to recoil when I say this, but for different spiritual and faith-based programs in terms of fighting off drug addiction. I mean, the numbers are there. I wrote about this in my book I did called Spiritual Envy. But let me go to some more calls here, and let's bring Timothy on. Timothy, you're on.
Hey, can you hear me all right?
Can hear you.
All right, fantastic. I live in the Southeast Mission. I guess it's an area that's probably well on your radar as being an enclave. Outside my door, there's probably several hundred people living in a tent city. I guess my comment is twofold here. On the one hand, I hate to sort of legitimize what I think are these kind of terrible sort of knee-jerk reactions by people that sort of say, hey, look, this thing's getting kind of out of control here. What's going on? And not really looking at the complexity of it, but to sort of give a little bit on that position. It definitely is very different where I live from 5-10 years ago. The community, we've had a hell of a lot more break-ins, and it's palpably different, if I can use the word vibe. Yeah, so there is something serious that shifted. I'm not convinced it's just dope. I think there's certainly other things come into play there. There's definitely people up 24 hours a day cracking bicycles outside, so there's maybe some other stuff mixing in here. But the point I have here is, I think we do have a serious crisis, and I think it definitely needs to be addressed. We're running out of options and starting to turn into, you know, having to call the police more than interacting with the community that we don't, you know, in my community, we don't want to have this sort of situation where we're calling police. It's like we'd like to interact, and we used to, and I used to know several of the guys that lived outside. So, yeah, things have changed. Through circumstance, I've had the luck of spending a lot of time in Northern Europe and seeing the real advantages of housing first policies, and I guess that's really where my call is to legitimize this. This is definitely real, what's going on, and then just wondering what your thoughts are on these housing first ideas and how we bring that to San Francisco.
All right, thank you for the call, Gary Camille.
Yeah, well, clearly, I mean, housing first is the best practice in dealing with housing. It has to be accompanied with an array of supportive services when you're talking about, you know, the chronically homeless who tend to be triple or quadruple diagnosed individuals. So just putting them in a house, while a necessary first step, is not sufficient. And the cities, you know,
but you need a whole array of services.
You need a whole array of services. You know, Dr. Barry Zevin pointed out to me that a lot of the injection drug users that he deals with out of the Tom Waddell Center have cognitive issues. So a lot of individuals not only have mental health issues and substance use issues and physical issues, but somebody hit them on the head with a 2x4. Somebody stabbed them in the brain. They can't remember to go to their appointment because their brain doesn't function right. So that's the first thing he does, is actually try to determine.
And so many are in pain. I mean, you know, you read the, I mean, yeah, obviously emotional, mental pain,
right,
but physical pain. And that's how they get on the opioids, and that's
right,
where the whole trajectory begins. And, you know, I couldn't help in reading these portraits in their own words. You know, how, well, there's one young woman, for example, who compares the heroin high to the greatest orgasm you could imagine times a million. You know,
right,
you think, how do you compete with that sort of feeling for somebody who's feeling vacant inside and empty? And so, and then, of course, the other trajectory is getting off it, and how difficult it is and how painful it is and so forth. And that's pretty much the paradigm right there.
Right. I mean, one doctor that we interviewed said that the best way to think of withdrawal is it's the exact corollary of the high. As high as the high is, and everyone that I spoke to about it said that it's pretty damn amazing. You know, just everything from orgasms to being in your mother's womb to a complete sense of peace. The withdrawal is equally awful. And, you know, the word kicking actually comes from the leg kicks of agony, of leg cramps. That's one of the many nightmarish physical effects of withdrawal. So, yeah, I mean, people are searching for the high. It's very complicated. I think it's not, you know, there is definitely a desire to get high, but also, as you say, people have this emptiness, they have this trauma, and more
than anything.
And
search becomes everything.
And, I mean, and it becomes, you know, everything. Yeah. And really, they talk, users really talk more than about getting high. They talk about getting well. They're sick. Most users are sick. They're avoiding being sick. That's the motivation. That's the driving force why this is a brain disease. You're in this desperate sickness so much of the day, and you just have to spend 24/7, whether it's panhandling, like Frank, who's an ethical guy who wouldn't steal, but unfortunately not everyone's so ethical.
A lot of them steal from their own family. I mean, they do things that are just, and they feel this guilt and regret and everything, but nevertheless, they have to feed the habit. I'm looking at, in fact, some comments here. Noel writes, we need to address the chronic pain crisis along with inequality. Start implementing a harm reduction model instead of the punitive model. But several comments about Portugal, interestingly enough. Listener writes, check out this weekend's New York Times article about what Portugal is doing. Rick writes, Portugal seems to have a very enlightened approach to drug use and addiction. Know about this?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think Portugal now is, I believe, the only country in the world that has completely decriminalized all drugs, including heroin. And yeah, I mean, I think there's an argument to be made. The Drug Policy Alliance certainly makes this very compelling argument that it's time for us to essentially move away from the entire criminal justice moralistic view of substance use, and that if you actually, you know, make them legal, you remove the criminal element, you allow people to use. It's incredibly, you know, it's incredibly complicated because the United States is not Portugal. You know, the United States is this massive country with these huge social pathologies. When you walk the streets of a European city, you can just tell, you know, that they haven't experienced the same degree of social fragmentation that we do. So, you know, you're talking about a far, far larger problem and a far different different demographic. But I still think that the caller is right, that there's much to be said for looking into decriminalization.
And here's Guillermo from Oakland. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. You mentioned early in the interview that the drugs companies were one of the ones who started the whole kind of prescription. It was easy. People would not get addicted to this. So where are the drugs companies staying at this time when it's a big mess, out of control? They're the ones who profit out of the whole equation. And now just let the constitutions pay for, our taxes are paying for now for the solutions that the drug companies mess are doing. Then why are not collaborating in this issue?
Well, I think that the drug companies certainly, you know, I think they'd probably acknowledge now that they made a very both serious mistake, and some of it was not a mistake. Some of it was unethical and venal and you know, intentional.
The drug companies and the medical practitioners.
Yeah, there was collusion, and there was also ignorance, and there was, you know, the book Dreamland, you know, points out there's almost a surreal origin of this problem, where there was one very minor study that was like a letter written to the New England Journal of Medicine that was not even this researcher's best study. And through a kind of a telephone game, this claim that prescription opioids were not addictive got blown up, and then the media began to cite it as this longitudinal study. I mean, is it not a good... The media also, you know, doesn't come off very well in this. But yeah, there are many, many players that are to blame. I think that obviously the pharmaceutical companies have all kinds of problems, and all, you know, even now, the price of naloxone, Narcan, has been, you know, skyrocketed by pharmaceutical companies. This is an outrage. You know, this is the life-saving drug. This is the drug that will save your life if your respiratory system is stopped, which is what happens when you OD on heroin. You stop breathing. You stick a needle of naloxone into somebody, and you'll save their life. Well, it's unconscionable that in response to market demand, the price of this drug has shot up.
So, all right, we've got seconds left, Gary. Just a good place to end would be with Gail's question, if you could answer quickly. What's the best thing a San Francisco resident can do to ensure that the city government supports the harm reduction approach?
Well, talk to your politicians and volunteer. Go to a needle exchange, meet users. That helps them a lot, knowing that somebody cares about them.
Well, actually, the care comes through in these articles. Thank you for them. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Gary Camille is executive editor of San Francisco Magazine, and we're about to end this first hour, but we're going to talk about healthcare on the next hour. Zeke Emanuel will be joining us, and he's got a book out on it, and, well, there are things happening as we're speaking here in Washington. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of the Minetti Schrem Museum of Art at UC Davis, who believe that all people deserve access to education and culture to enrich a lifetime of exploration and learning.